The Rohatsu Sesshin ship is now out of sight of the nearest land. Nothing but endless line of horizon in the distance. The ocean and sky start to blend into one blue blur. Here's some talks from Kobun, our founder, Sesshin Talks. It's in a Rohatsu Sesshin section, and he's talking about the second and third days. You know, pain is going to happen. It surely happens in hips and legs. I cannot pretend it doesn't happen. It happens! Exclamation point. Standing up, bending, doing something in the same form for a long time naturally gives us the same kind of painful situation. Have you noticed the flavor of sesshin? And none of us can know how it is for anyone else. Each of us has our own experience. So, probably have some discomfort, maybe some people very painful, some maybe not so much. Each of us has to work it out for ourselves, but I would say that if it's the dominant thing of just like, if your mind just goes to like how painful the body is, we're talking about physical pain here, then maybe possible to find different postures. I think, as I said before, like basically my feeling is like whatever you do with your legs, these are this kind of this problem down here sometimes, these legs. I think whatever you do with them is not the main issue. I think make them comfortable. For me, actually, I like sitting in full lotus, that some kind of energetic gathering the energy together and with those fully crossed legs generally works for me. But I wouldn't say it's like necessarily better. I think what, you know, and if it was excruciatingly painful, I don't think it would be good. So I think the upper body is the main thing that's the same with all these postures. Whether you're cross-legged, kneeling, chair sitting, however, the back is upright, the breathing is open, the head is balanced, the whole body is relaxed. And if the back starts to become very painful, then that's even harder, I think, to deal with. But I think we can still find a way to lean back on these straight back chairs, sit right up against the back, keep the back straight but supported. Sometimes even then, there's nothing else we can do. But I think, you know, let's make ourselves as comfortable as we can, especially those of us sitting for 7 days. Then Koban goes on to say, there's another feeling besides this physical body pain and sesshin, a feeling that some kind of policeman is inside of you judging your zazen. The important thing is not to judge your poor effort in sitting, but simply encourage yourself to reach to the present instead of directing yourself away. It's like a sailor sailing a boat in the storm. You have to be aware, but you also have to be aware that the storm is also yourself. You have to know why the storm is there and how the boat stays on the surface of the waves. That's the important point, I think, is you have to know the storm is yourself. They're making me do it. Whoever they are. The other policemen in there. They won't let me move. They won't let me go home. Take the life raft back to shore. Let this ship sail out here with the rest of those crazy people. I'm out of here. No, the lifeboat's always available, actually. So, you're all welcome to take the lifeboat back to shore, if you can. So, but you will decide to stay in the storm. You have to know why the storm is there and how the boat stays on the surface of the waves. If you resist the storm, it's impossible to sail, I think. What I am saying is that you're sitting, your body posture is like a little ship. The storm is where we live in this big world. Big stormy world. Koban is, I think, quite apologetic in some of these talks. I'm afraid that everyone is experiencing tremendous pain. Maybe in another talk he says, I'm really sorry about this. I feel bad about this. But here we are. As soon as you sit on the cushion about 5 or 10 minutes having a good time, here it comes. A lot of pain starts to be felt by your mind. Waiting for the kinhin bell, you have discovered what eternity means. It seems that being born as a human form of life has some very sacred meaning in not escaping but digesting our position in existence. Not escaping this painful body and mind situation. All the police force in our mind trying to manage the wild situation. But not escaping but digesting our position in existence. Even if we sit like a rock, I'm sure enormous pain is always there because of the rule of gravity. Having sensitivity embedded in our system is, in one sense, very wonderful, allowing us to know what's going on. In another sense, it's very inconvenient. Having sensitivity, having a nervous system. You may begin to feel tremendous pain as some kind of signal not to push yourself too far, a signal which you are ignoring. In Sesshin, this kind of stupid thing, the body saying, I think it's time to move. Actually, it was time to move a long time ago. well, that's okay that you say that, I'll keep sitting. In spite of all that, I also know that many of you have already experienced sitting as not just a continuous fight with pain, because you've discovered that the other side of pain is the intensity of knowing where you exist. This realization gives you joy. If we didn't have this nerve system embedded in our body, we wouldn't know where we are or what direction our body is facing. It seems like he's saying something about just feeling this body-mind experience is really tasting the intensity of life, of our position, knowing where we exist. Sometimes we're not even quite aware of the body or mind. We're wrapped up in busyness. So sesshin could be seen as just a moment-by-moment direct experience of life in a human body and mind. And our job is to just simply not meddle around too much with this experience. Maybe not even meddle at all. Just experience and experience. So, Vasubandhu, our 4th century Indian ancestor, has this treatise called the Hotsu Bodai Shin Kyo Ron, the treatise on the sutra of arousing the aspiration for awakening. Bodhisattvas are born at the moment bodhicitta arises. The aspiration to let go of ourself completely for the great benefit to all beings without number. Surrendering this life to the whole. Finding this freedom that can meet everything and everyone with an open heart. And the aspiration, bodhicitta, is simply that aspiration to be awake, free, and drop off our self-centered concerns for the benefit of all living beings. And then the application, bodhicitta, how do we then practice in response to such an aspiration? Vasubandhu says, and the Buddha says, these 6 boundless practices of giving and harmlessness and patience and diligence and presence and total openness beyond openness. So giving or generosity is the first one. Dana, paramita. Dana, paramita. Giving. Back in the old days in China, in the golden age, a monk asked Wei Hai, by what means can the gateway of our Zen school be entered? How do you enter the Zen school? Wei Hai said, by means of Dana Paramita. A little bit unusual answer for a golden age Zen teacher.
By means of?
Dana Paramita.
Dana.
Dana means giving or generosity, and Paramita means gone beyond or transcendent generosity, boundless generosity. By means of boundless giving, Dana Paramita. The monk said, according to the Buddha, the Bodhisattva path comprises six paramitas, six boundless practices. Why have you mentioned only this one? Please explain why this one alone provides a sufficient means for us to enter the Zen gate. Wei Hai said, deluded people fail to understand that the other five all proceed from Dana Paramita. The other five practices all proceed from giving, and that by its practice all the others are fulfilled. The monk asked, why is it called Dana Paramita? Boundless giving. Wei Hai said, Dana means relinquishment. That's another definition of giving. We're holding something, we have something. In order to give, we have to have something. I think. Can't think of any example of giving something that you don't have in some way or another. So, dana, giving, is actually relinquishing what we have. The monk asked, relinquishment of what? Wei Hai said, relinquishment of the duality of opposites, which means relinquishment of ideas as to the dual nature of good and bad, being and non-being, empty and not empty, pure and impure, and so on. So, Dana Paramita, transcendent giving, is giving up dualistic views, relinquishing dualistic views. And then we could say, from that, then all kinds of other giving naturally emerge. In fact, there's the practice of giving, but strictly speaking, Dana Paramita, boundless or transcendent giving, or giving beyond giving, is, as we say in the meal chant, as we open our bowls to about to receive a wonderful gift of nourishment from the Tenzo, we say, may all beings realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. In other words, in this activity of someone giving something to someone else, the giver, the receiver, and the gift can't really be found as anything separate. It's just one ungraspable activity. That's Dana Paramita. So, in relinquishment of all duality, all ideas about a separate giver, receiver, and gift, that's what Hui Hai is saying is the Dhanaparamita, from which all these other bodhisattva practices flow forth. Aitken Roshi, in commenting on this, says, "This total relinquishment is the self-forgotten, the dropped-away body and mind. It is still a center, but it is outflowing." The dropped-off body and mind, like there's still some center, as I understand what he's saying. There's still like some location here. But this location that we used to call body and mind is now just an outflowing giving. The dropped-away body and mind is still a center, but it is outflowing. The food and housing and clothing and money, it requires to function. That this center requires to function, are metabolized as giving. It's a great image, huh? So for the bodhisattva, it's dropped off body and mind. Still, you need to feed this center, and you need to clothe this center, and various things that this center requires. This dropped off body has some needs, but the food and housing and clothing and money that this center requires to function are metabolized as giving. In other words, you digest the food, clothing, and shelter, and the result of that metabolism is called giving. You follow that? Like the digestion of these physical needs, the energy that results from feeding the body is now called giving. Instead of just called like my life for a bodhisattva, food is metabolized as giving back. Yeah? What a beautiful image. We eat to be able to serve, in other words. The ordinary way of receiving in order to receive even more becomes transformed into a way of sustaining the self in order to practice the Buddha's wisdom and compassion. And he, Aitken Roshi, nuances this a little bit. He says, yet eating to serve, which is a great, I think, great way to look at, Why are we eating this delicious food that Denzo is preparing? We're just eating in order to serve, and our serving this week, maybe sometimes literally serving, but maybe also just our zazen is this great service. I think we have to see this zazen practice as a service to the world. But he says, Aitken says, eating to serve has a slightly righteous tone. Yeah. It's a great phrase, but it might have a maybe too exalted to even say that. Eating to serve has a slightly righteous tone. If the self is outflowing, what is the stuff that flows out? Is it simply obligation? I hope not. Is it self-sacrifice? Perhaps it is when viewed from outside. From a personal perspective, however, you will find that it is easier and more natural than the word sacrifice implies. Yeah? I have to give myself to all beings. It's like this great sacrifice. I will make this noble sacrifice for all beings. But from a personal perspective, it's easier and more natural than that. It's just what we do, as I would understand. Also, it's important to take care of the one who gives, otherwise the flow dries up. Recreation, recreation, is important for the bodhisattva. Bodhisattva's recreational activity is sitting still for 7 days. Does anyone remember the three types of dana or giving, traditionally sometimes put as three types, three kinds of giving, three things you could give that can be given? Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's I think a nice one of the numerous Dharma lists to remember. Three types of giving: material giving. This we usually often just think of that kind of giving, but also Dharma giving and giving fearlessness or protection from fear. And Dharma giving, Vasubandhu here says, the giving of Dharma. As for the giving of Dharma, one encourages people to practice the precepts, encourages other people to refrain from harming others, and to cultivate this mind of renunciation for the sake of letting go of false views. One explains the faults inherent in the manifold mistakes flowing from the views of annihilationism and eternalism. So sometimes bodhisattvas give by explaining the middle way, free from the faults of annihilationism, meaning like there's nothing here, period. There's nothing real, and there's no more discussion about it, and therefore nothing matters whatsoever. It's kind of like annihilationism. And eternalism is like, you know, everything is totally, solidly real, exactly like it appears to be totally real, and therefore we're in a big problematic mess, and I don't think it can be solved because it's fixed. So bodhisattvas give Dharma by showing the problems with both of those extreme views of nihilism or annihilationism and eternalism or ultra-realism. And they teach the middle way of dependent arising and ceasing appearances. And one distinguishes and explains the meaning of ultimate truth, emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift. One praises the meritorious qualities of diligence, explaining the faults of negligence. This is what's meant by the giving of Dharma. That's, you know, old style. Giving like Dharma teachings about these things. But, you know, when I consider this, I feel like the ultimate Dharma giving is exactly what we're doing. This is the of any kind of like Dharma that we could practice. Sesshin is the most straightforward, complete, unadulterated Dharma, and we just give ourselves to Sesshin, we give ourselves to this one period of Zazen, we give ourselves moment to moment. This is Dharma giving. I think this is like the most amazing Dharma giving, even if it might seem like, well, my mind is actually just like churning away over here, and I'm not even really sitting Sesshin anyway, even though I'm keeping my butt on the cushion. I think even just to keep your butt on the cushion is actually amazing Dharma gift to the other people trying to keep their butts on the cushion and to the rest of the world, inconceivably, and conceivably. May our sitting be a gift. May we intend for it to be a gift. May we, when we're starting to scope out the ship for where, at least for where the lifeboats might be kept, in case we might need them later, as we're doing that, on this ship as a gift. Being on this journey, I make it a gift. Supreme Dharma gift. I think sometimes we naturally have that sense. We can feel that. We're sitting in the stillness. We're receiving all at the same time. We're receiving and giving. Zazen, the Supreme Dharma gift. And then we have giving fearlessness or protection from fear. And Vasubandhu says the giving of fearlessness. In an instance where the Bodhisattva observes beings beset by fear of representatives of the king. In old India, people were afraid of representatives of the king. In other words, corrupt tax collectors and maybe corrupt policemen that shoot before asking, and so on. Ironically, the first thing on the list that Bodhisattvas protect people from is these government people whose job it should be to help people. But sometimes the Bodhisattva has to protect others from them. I guess they had these issues in old India in the 4th century. Maybe some, I hope that some representatives of the king also are bodhisattvas that help protect others. I think the king and the king's representatives, ideally, that's their main job, actually, is to protect others from fear. But the bodhisattva also protects others from fear of these representatives. And also fear from lions, tigers, wolves, floods, fire, bandits, or insurgents, trying to rescue and protect them. This is the giving of fearlessness. Interestingly, these wild animals, lions, tigers, and wolves, in another classic text, it says one of the main ways bodhisattvas protect others from fear is they protect these animals from fear by rescuing them. It mentioned, buying sheep on their way to market and letting them free in the forest, and small creatures also, like worms and insects. This text mentioned, so of course I thought of the ceremony that we do once or twice a year. We release crickets to protect them from fear. It's a kind of giving, let's say. We're giving fearlessness to those crickets. Now, are they really afraid in that box, fearing the reptile? And these are crickets from the pet store, destined to be eaten by reptiles. I think their brains are very tiny. But maybe one of the first things, even in a tiny brain, maybe one of the first emotions or mind experiences of beings, at least I could imagine one of the first might be fear. I think it's very primitive. It's in the amygdala. The reptilian brain is the fear brain. And then the more advanced brain kind of like grows around that. But maybe even very tiny creatures have fear and how to protect them, save them from possible death. And then we have this, you know, material giving. Vasubandhu says in old India, material, giving material wealth, where one gives material wealth and remains free of miserliness, even where such giving extends up to jewels, elephants, horses. Someday it would be so great to give away an elephant. Carriages, silks, grains, clothing, food and drink, and even extending down to a scoop of fried flour. Maybe that was chapati, or a roti, or a strand of thread to patch your robes. And where one matches the aims of the supplicants by bestowing on them whatever they may need. A little bit wordy way of saying, I think, giving people like the things that they would like. Matching the aims of the supplicants. No matter whether it be much or little, this is the giving of material wealth. And in another one of these classic texts about Dana Paramita, Nagarjuna brings up this image of a kind of a metaphor for when a house is on fire, an intelligent person, when their house is on fire, an intelligent person goes into their house and extricates all their valuables, getting them out of the house before the house burns down. Whereas a foolish person just tries to protect the house in vain, but the house is already like, the whole thing is burning. So why don't you better get your stuff out? So I thought this was a kind of moving analogy of us living in this burning house called human life, this impermanent body, and we're trying to put out the fire of impermanence in vain. And we don't know when we're going to die, but we will. Seems pretty likely at some point. And so before the house burns down, let's extricate our material valuables. It means basically like, before we die, let's give away whatever we have. It's kind of a nice image, I think. We might say, well, the house is just smoldering right now. It's going to last a long time, so. But I think maybe if people know that their death is approaching, then I think they naturally do start clearing stuff out. Although it's amazing, it seems like some, you know, very old people that know they don't have very long, even like they have like a month or something, they still like maybe collecting some more stuff and like, oh, and I can't get rid of this, it's really important to me. And I think we'd naturally feel this way because even if we know the end is coming, on some level we can't quite grok that. We still feel like, well, in some ways, doesn't this stuff, isn't there part of me that continues? The part of me that has this stuff? How great to give it. Yes.
Fearlessness.
Yeah.
That one interests me. Others from pain or suffering, that is making them less fearful, I suppose.
I think that's another way we could give fearlessness. Yeah, is teaching fearlessness.
That would be Dharma.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why that would be Dharma. Or it could just be like us being fearless. If we actually wanted to teach fearlessness, probably the best way to teach it would be for us to be as fearless as possible. For example, in some big, when big disasters happening to a group of people, if we can stay calm and somewhat fearless, I think that is a great gift. If we freak out, then others look at us and say, well, I guess I'm supposed to freak out too. Especially if bodhisattvas, well, let's see what the bodhisattvas do. Oh, they're freaking out. I guess I should freak out. But yeah, I think, and it may be that actually protecting others from fear also may be a way to show them how to be fearless too, because if we're risking, maybe we're risking our own life to protect someone from fear, they're like, wow, it protected me from fear and it showed me that that person is pretty fearless to protect me from fear. So I think it's, yeah, both. All these things very nicely work together on the bodhisattva path, usually. Material giving is an interesting point. It's some of the old commentaries, they say, well, this, you know, that particular material giving was taught for lay bodhisattvas who have things, and then monastic bodhisattvas don't have anything, basically much of anything to give, so they just have to do the Dharma giving. Renunciants don't have much material to give, and that's okay, I think the Buddha's saying. Then they have another kind of giving that they really have to pay attention to, and I was talking with my friend Satya the other day about this, because you know, about this renunciate lifestyle that he really keeps now, and I in the past, I think it was 3 or 4 years, I lived completely without money. Like, I didn't have any savings and I didn't receive any. And just to see how that would work. And it worked pretty much okay, actually. Maybe part of one of the main things I learned, I was living at No Abode Hermitage. So I was living in a practice place, and we would collect our food in the traditional way with the alms bowl in Mill Valley. And so all their donations. And because of the setup, it worked out okay, but I think one of the main things I noticed is that it greatly simplified my life, and it may be partly why the Buddha kind of taught that, recommended that in the old days for the monks. It's just like you won't be too busy, probably. I mean, you could get really busy collecting food, I suppose, but we would just do that like once a week. But it meant that a lot of things that I did before then and that I have done after then, I didn't do for those years. Because so many things involve money, right? And so in that environment, it worked out pretty well, because I would just do a lot of zazen. And there were Dharma books around already there. They cost money, but there were some there. And occasional things like this is from the Buddha's time. He set it up that you could have like a steward who would the monks could have somebody who, like, if somebody wanted to give like a monetary gift, they could give it to that steward, and then the steward could get some food or something. You could say, well, is that kind of cheating? And maybe from a really strict point of view, it might be. Buddha allowed it for the monks, but I had this kind of a steward like this, and it served a function for me of basically, like, I didn't have any privacy around what I got. I had to basically, if I wanted like I remember I did get a few books during those few years, Dharma books, but I'd have to ask this person. I think maybe my parents gave him a little money, and so I could request a book, but I have to be really careful because I didn't want to abuse that. I didn't want to ask him for anything frivolous because he was kind of like going out of his way to do this, play that role. So it kept me like really honest, and like I just things that I would maybe buy myself that I, you know, I don't mind. But if I have to kind of like make the effort to ask this out of town person to get something, I wouldn't ask for like a chocolate bar. But now I like to buy chocolate bars, and I don't think it's a bad thing actually to buy chocolate bars. But at that time, it simplified my life.
And in the extreme of that, the question of cultivation arises, and you know, I mean, I've explored and read and thought about, well, with hunter-gathering asceticism.
Well, it wasn't. I think asceticism maybe usually refers to like an intentional practice of, say, simplicity for simplicity's sake.
But not cultivating.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you could say, well, you should, why beg? You should, you know, like they did for the monastery.
Uh-huh.
You should start farming. But farming changes everything.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the beginning of a whole new world.
It's ownership. It's for one.
For one, and civilization.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Not that we're ever going to get away from that, but it's an interesting idea to practice without cultivating, just with what's available.
Yeah, yeah. That's the more like the begging style. Because, and there's plenty to go around anyway. So, but anyway, I bring this up partly because I was talking with Satya about, because I was thinking about giving, and I remembered those years, and I felt like, for me, I think it was a little bit of a problem at that time because I couldn't do this material giving. I was doing the Dharma giving thing by just practicing. And it was this hermitage where I wasn't even around many other people. But I felt like I want my practice to just be a gift. But without being able to, I would receive a lot materially, but I wouldn't be able to do the material giving. And I felt like, For me at that time, I think after I came out of that, I felt like, something, there was a little missing piece there. I think I could have made things maybe. I mean, I think I did maybe like make some artwork for my parents and things like that. But now I use money again, and I really enjoy giving, using the money to make gifts, especially to, like, you know, the very poor and some of these. It brings me great joy to donate to, like, you know, Doctors Without Borders. You know, I think they're a great group. You know, they're going to war zones and they don't take political sides. I think no matter what, even if it seems really crazy what's going on, that we're a neutral party of volunteer doctors and low-paid doctors going into extremely horrific circumstances and just medically helping everybody on both sides of a conflict. And sometimes just, you know, also not just conflicts, but drought and places like this, and physically helping people, and they have, you know, I think they low overhead for what they do, and, you know, Oxfam famine relief and organizations that help people to get back on their feet, growing their own food and so on. Just to be able to kind of enact that process of material giving like that, And I guess it's just because I have it, so now I can. If I didn't have it, then I think that's okay. But it's a question for me. How does one? I think partly at that time in my life, at when I was living at No Abode, in this much more renunciate kind of way, almost like my identity became more like a receiver. I think in my psyche, I became like a receiver, and I think maybe wasn't so good to just be on that side of things. Maybe I could have found other ways to practice giving more.
And in a subtle way, it has to do with the redistribution of wealth. You know, you're starting it at a small level, but maybe that got encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Gates, who does, you know, then wealth starts to move around a little more.
Yeah, like material wealth is just like energy, actually, right? I can see it that way now. Money is kind of like energy, and it's an interesting, powerful, powerful energy in this world, isn't it? I mean, it's an energy that can totally corrupt people, ruin people. People kill and are killed by their like illusory beliefs in this energy. I mean, really, in a big way, right? I mean, it's crazy. But then, if we can use it's hot, dangerous, kind of like powerful energy, it can totally ruin people, and it can totally benefit people in amazing ways. So how to use money, energy, in a, to just keep it flowing. Keep it flowing. It's like, we need some for ourselves.
Money is like muck, not good unless it's spread.
Money's like muck, not good unless it's spread. That's a good one.
But it would be a nice practice to sort of try to be aware of when you're a center with the energy going out. I mean, like you said, you were more aware then of being a receiver.
Yeah, the energy coming in.
You know, we can all think of situations when we feel that the energy is moving outward.
It's a heart thing.
Giving, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to just try to be aware of that.
Yeah.
Energy, or cultivate, to use your term. Energy. That's a nice image that you can.
Yeah. Yeah, and be aware of it, because actually I think it is often, it's happening all the time in small ways and big ways. And just like, you know, just in a conversation like that, one person putting something out is like a kind of a gift flowing forth from the center to kind of like, you know, enrich a conversation. So I'd be like, well, that's not really like a gift, but well, maybe it is, actually. It's naturally. And how to see, again, is the same things like the material world can seem like not like muck spread everywhere, but like, you know, very like, all the rules we have to play by, and like the deal-making mind, right? And the very same activities could be shifted slightly in our view to see it as a flow of gift. Like, the Buddha set up the Sangha to be a kind of a Dana-based organization, right? And we try to keep that spirit. So it gets tricky, you know, in modern times and how organizations work. But like I do appreciate how we have here at the Zen Center, we say, like for Sashin, we say suggested donation, right? And some organizations, I think they say that and it means like it's really a fee, but we're putting that like in quotes. If somebody says, could I give, well, it's a suggestion, right? So how about just a penny? And well, no, it suggests, I mean, we really, you can't come in unless you give the suggested donation amount. Then I think we, you know, I think sometimes it gets worked that way. I think we do pretty good here, actually, about, we try to mean it, suggested donation, and it's really okay if it's not that amount. It's almost like I could see suggested donation would be like if somebody thinks, well, what would be the, I just don't know what's like appropriate or what's would be like, I want somebody to tell me actually. I've been in situations where I felt like, well, what's an appropriate thing to give here? I don't know. It's nice to have a suggestion, and it's nice when it's just a suggestion. Oh, well, but actually that's a little bit steep. So I think that's good. I think sometimes the Enos who've collected the donations for Sesshin, sometimes will even like, is this right, Patrick? Will sometimes leave an envelope, like in the office or something, and say, you just put it in there. I don't even want to know how much. Have you done it that way?
Nanette does the envelope.
Oh, okay.
I've in the past said, just put something in the box and then tell me you've put something in the box.
Mm. Of course, the treasurer likes to track things.
One's got a check back because it, or an inquiry because I didn't say what it was for.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The budget, a lot, you know, allocation things. Right? So, yeah. I think the spirit of, like, how to see something as a gift rather than like a fee, I think is a nice thing. Maybe even at the store, buying food or something, is there a way to instead of saying, "Well, it just costs this much, so we're doing this is the deal," and if you gave it to me, if you said you don't have to pay today, maybe most of us would say, "Oh, okay," and I won't. But maybe there's a way to, at least if we're going to at the store or if we're out buying, maybe there's a way to say, "Actually, I just want to give this. I have it because I have it, and I don't need this much that was I was going to give you." So maybe there's a way to see it like, I'm just giving this gift, and oh, thank you for the food. I'm giving you this gift to support your livelihood, and oh, thank you for the food that you just gave me. I think we usually don't think this way, but could maybe just shift the deal-making mind into like a mutual giving mind. Yes?
I've taken classes at the Sati Center. Is that Redwood City?
Oh, yeah.
And it's all by Dada. And I don't have a clue.
There's no suggestions.
They don't give suggestions. Mm. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it makes me think. You know, I know what we charge for classes, for instance, and I think I probably base it on events that I've been to with other Dharma centers.
Sometimes I've heard people compare things to like, without giving an amount, they'll just say, "Well, just if you sometimes go out to the movies, it's like what, $10 or something these days. They're a lot, right? So it's like for like a 2-hour movie, you could say there's something that's kind of that you do for that. So think of like this 2-hour class, say, might not be as entertaining as a movie. But But you might say, here's something to think about, a kind of amount of time, amount you spend on to do something for a certain amount of time that you don't really need to do, but you're doing it for your edification. Yeah, I think that anything like the spirit of Dana, I think is how to really keep that alive and not get caught by like our society's usual setup of like fixed prices and costs for things, because the Dharma is priceless and practice is priceless, and if it was completely up to me, I think it would be nice to try having. I mean, I guess if we really mean our suggested donation that way, and we really keep telling people that's what it means, then maybe that is a Dana model. But then certain events we charge, and I confess that part of it is that then some of it goes to me, right? So, but I think it'd be a complicated thing, but I brought up before, but it's scary, it's a little scary, I think, but I would be willing to not have a fixed, like, stipend and just have, like, a Dana model just to, like, be more into the, more aware that we're really, all of this is giving. It's scary because our society is so based on the deal-making mind that we're afraid that if we say there's no more cost, whatever you want, then we'll feel like people, because we're so used to the deal mind, then everyone will take advantage of that. Oh, that means free. Unless they're going to charge me something, I don't give anything. I think maybe like that's what how our society has created, that kind of spirit, maybe.
Well, Dogen talks about that everybody has their, at least the monks, they're allotted.
Yeah.
But they're allotted for life.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that you don't need to concern yourself about it.
Yeah. That's a great image of Dogen, yeah. That was really moving to me. And I put that section of the Zui Monkey on the wall when I was practicing these years at Nobo, actually. He says, I think he's saying everybody, not just monks. I think he says everybody in his life is like, kind of like allotted a certain amount in their life. And if you try to get more, you won't get more. And if you try to have less, you won't have less. So it's almost like, sounds like a kind of predestined thing. I don't know what exactly he means, but I think he's just saying, it's not in our control. Nothing's in our control. It's all dependent co-arising. So I think he says, like, just leave it to fate and don't worry about it. And he says, just practice. So I think that was the key little thing that I remember he says at the bottom. Just practice and don't worry about it. You could say, if you just kind of hang out and don't do any practice and don't try to live for the benefit of all beings, then things might not work out so well. But if you practice with the Bodhisattva spirit, because you love to and you want to be of benefit, then I think things get taken care of.
Now, Kogan used to say that, that you don't have to worry about the money coming if your intention is there and you're practicing.
Yeah.
The money will come.
Yeah.
There's no need to be concerned about it.
Yeah. Hard to trust this sometimes.
It's been since the beginning, there's systems of power
that
really actually reinforce wealth. And unfortunately, we do, even while the dominant, while we're trying to encourage ourselves to have a mind of giving and, operate more in the mode of gift, we do still have a roof and we feed ourselves in Sishin. And then there's the mother of the homeless family on the street that, you know, out in the rain.
Yeah.
It's so big.
It's so big. Mm-hmm. So that's a good point. And, you know, we could get into uncomfortable territory if we really then, you know, apply Dogen's teaching to this and we say, well, really, but that's what he's saying is that, it's a dependently arisen thing. So some people, it's like you say, it's always been this way. There'll always be the super rich and maybe they can't get rid of it. And then the super poor. And that's how it is. But I think it's okay to say that if we say, and part of this whole dependent arising situation is that we can try to help if there's situations where we can help the homeless on the street, then it's like we don't want to use this to say like, well, that they have their allotment, so I shouldn't give them more, right?
No.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the way a tax system works, that you get a big tax deduction for owning a home, and you pay a lot of tax as a renter. You know, there's a lot of systems that kind of recreate poverty. And, But, of course, I do, and I always, I think it's really important, essential practice to always be studying what
he's giving. Yeah. I think maybe when...
I don't know how to line it up. I just had to say that.
Yeah. Maybe when Dogen gives instructions like that, I think I hear that as like, that's instructions for us, like, you know, for these particular practitioners, about worrying about oneself. And maybe we don't want to use those instructions to justify where someone else is at. So I think it's like almost like it's a personal, like I think in general the teachings about, you know, the suffering situation that we're in right now is due to our past karma. I think that's a good teaching for me to hear and apply to my practice, but we don't want to then tell that to you're suffering because of your karma, so just suck it up, or just deal with it. You know, we don't want to put it on somebody else. We want to just try to help however we can. But for our, when we're worrying about ourselves, then I think these kind of teachings are good. Right? I appreciate that for myself. When I'm suffering, I've suffered a few times in this session. Already. And I can really see, oh, this really is due to my karma, my suffering. I mean, we can say there's other conditions going on too, but when I examine my own discontent, I see, oh, this is like karmically created, this particular mind stream. I mean, that is one story it's even, the Diamond Sutra says something like this, and it even got made into one of the koans in the Book of Serenity, just excerpted from the sutra, very unusual koan. It's something like bodhisattvas, when they receive painful situations, are, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but something like they're something like using, I don't know if it has the word using up their karma, but something like I think this is why it's a koan. They excerpt it and put it. What does this work? Because I don't think it's some metaphysical principle that you're actually burning off karma. I mean, we can get into weird ideas about this, but I think it's a koan, and that suffering is the result of past actions, and that by experiencing the results, that result now is experienced and doesn't have to be again. There will be other results. So
it's just that thought to me comforts me. If you even.
Yeah, yeah, that's the comforting part.
I feel like, well, good. I'm glad.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's getting paid off. Yeah.
I think it's maybe not quite as simple as that, but I think that way too. I mean, I think that's why, again, I think it's a koan, because that would be the simple way that comforts us, and maybe other religions have this kind of thing too. It's like when hard times come, it's like we're kind of paying off this debt, sort of. But yeah, you know, maybe more subtle.
It's like when somebody gets put in jail for what they did. I mean,
it's cause and effect.
Yeah, but it doesn't really get rid of the karma.
Although it might. Yeah, it might, like in that case, I know some people said, I've heard some people say, going to jail at that time in my life was the best possible thing that ever happened to me. It saved my life. Yeah, yeah. So sometimes, yeah.
Going to the jail, it's remarkable how many people are there for no reason. Their perception is, I didn't do anything. I mean, we had a guy in the last couple of weeks that was really suffering because he felt it was so out of line. It was like he had no idea what he was doing. And I found that so odd.
Yeah, yeah.
That his suffering was so apparent.
Of course there are, you know, many unjust imprisonings. And at the same time, it's like, if you end up in jail, like, it's not totally random, right? Something happened. We were in some situation. We're with the wrong people, maybe. We weren't one of them, but we were with them. Like, and so there's part of the conditions.
But there's really, I think now there's a lot of mass incarceration and there's for-profit prisons. So I think we're really wading into very difficult
Yeah.
There's a story that broke just before session of a man who the policeman put him in a chokehold in Staten Island, and he had just been in an argument with them about they were policing and or they were on the streets, and they got into an argument with this man about he shouldn't be selling cigarettes without collecting tax. And he's like, it was all recorded on the cell phone. You know, you're just harassing me again. The police are just harassing people on the streets. And because he spoke up with a loud voice, they circled him. This one police officer put him in a chokehold, and he died.
Wow.
And the grand jury did not indict the police officer. It was huge. I mean, I think there's protests all over the country.
And there's another example of like political protests trying to do something good, and people go to jail for that. So, but you could say, yeah, they're in jail because of karma, but good karma. Sometimes could be this case, but cause and effect can't escape from. And we don't really know how it all plays out. So, if we find ourselves in jail or on the second day of a sesshin, or I don't know what you choose. or anywhere else. That cause and effect brought us to this moment, and each moment from now on, may we meet the moment with a mind of giving ourself to what's happening. In that way, giving and receiving may be very much the same. Completely receiving what's happening is like giving ourselves to what's happening.
Even if we're not in sesshin, the same suffering is there, but in sesshin, you have an opportunity to do something about it.
Yeah, we just get to see it close up under the magnifying glass of sesshin. Yeah, I think that's it. Is Kobin says that elsewhere in here too. He's like, pain is a constant, actually. We're always in pain, and it's just this sesshin, we become really aware of it, mental and physical, because we're just not doing anything else. So we really get to understand it more and more deeply. Like we chanted this morning, the Buddha's first teaching, the vision, the knowledge, the wisdom, the awareness, the light that arose in him with regard to things that he never realized before was, this is the noble truth of suffering, discontent, and this suffering must be fully understood. This suffering has been fully understood. That's the, you know, each of the noble truths has a practice. The origin of suffering is relinquished. The cessation of suffering is realized. The path to the cessation is followed. But suffering, the noble truth of suffering, must be fully understood with what is this suffering? That's our job as the butt meets the cushion. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.